If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome. We are live at the Huddle Breakdown. Once again, Enda has abandoned us, so you're stuck with Alan and I. Alan from Celtic by Numbers, how are you doing today?
I'm very well. Yeah. Sad to be without Enda, but I think you know what we need to emphasize, because I'm sure Enda will be watching this eventually, is Enda, you're in Spain. I don't know if you're still in Bilbao. But look, son, you need to behave, okay? When you're there, just behave. I know you once dropped a paper cup in the street. We don't want any repeat of that, Not bothered about the churches and the statues of popes, a bit Catholic-y, isn't it? And the people, all those Mexican people in Spain. Not bothered about them either. But listen, we don't want any bad headlines for the Huddle Breakdown.
That's right.
No bad headlines. So just behave, son.
He better travel well and represent us accordingly. Well, now that fun is out of the way, we hope Enda's having a good time. And depending on logistics, we haven't even worked out our schedule as we go through the off season here, if we're going to do these or not for a while. Probably take a break at some point, but we'll figure this stuff out. Rank amateurs as we are, we'll just kind of fly by the seat of our pants. Along with that, because Enda is not here to host and produce, I am in a room with two live dogs who may bark at any moment. So Alan will have to go into long monologues if I end up with a spasm of barking in the back. And because I am hosting and we're going to try and keep the comments going here, at least try to read some. I have to wear glasses because I've hit middle age firmly, and despite having LASIK like 20 years ago, I'm once again descending into blindness. So apologies for the if there's any glare off of the glasses. Well, let's get to the fun, Alan. It's all done.
Champions again. Done.
Champions. What a delightful, fun weekend. A lot of emotions, a lot of just joy. I mean, as someone who watched it by myself in my family room, as the rest of my family slept in, you could feel it through the TV. It was palpable, just the sheer joy in the stadium. So how did you get on, and how did you get to enjoy it?
Yeah, oh, tremendously. I mean, the sun was out. The crowd was in great form. It was a very emotional day. I think with Rogic especially and Beaton moving on, and probably a few other players that we saw parading around, lovely to see the joy, the players' togetherness as well, and also the manager. I mean, I think during the game against end of the game against Dundee United, he kind of took me back a little bit, how emotional he was and how exhausted and drained he looked. I think this has been a real challenge for him, and I think it emphasises what he's done in terms of bringing this group of players, which I don't think is anywhere near the squad that he would ideally like to have, and getting them over the line. I mean, I think all the focus has been on the league. Some clubs will tell you blatant lies that the league wasn't the priority. straight into the Champions League. And I think he got that. We saw that in the Bordeaux-Glimt game. It was the most eye-raising moment of the season when we fielded a kind of weakened team in the against Bordeaux-Glimt. But the because his focus was all about getting this league title, and I think it's taken everything out of him to coax this group of players over that line. And I don't think we saw a hint of that, no hint of weakness. We've had no complaints, we've had no excuses, we've had nothing apart from, you know, just laser-like focus on getting to that finish line. So I think all that came to fruition in a kind of outpouring of relief and emotion. And it was a very emotional day. I was welling up when Rogic went off. It was quite hard, actually. So it was lovely. It was a great day.
Yeah, I echo those comments. I think it's really interesting. I mean, you get someone like Ange, who's, you know, quite obviously a switched on guy, very talented and ambitious professional. But even within that context, I mean, he walked into something that just was nowhere near anything that he had dealt with before. And we talked about this when we were going through kind of the epicenter of the injury barrage back in December. You know, to manage through 60 games. I mean, his time in Australia, when I wrote an article about that, I mean, he was playing 25, 30 games a season. Hmm. And to get into this 2 games a week routine and to do it really since July, I mean, it's just a totally different animal, I would think, for someone, you know, even with his long CV of success and accomplishment, it's just a total different animal to walk into that kind of schedule with the squad issues, with, you know, basically a unipolar force, probably lacking in resources to a degree that hopefully they're going to address coming into the summer. So if you just think about kind of conceptually all of those demands on this one individual, I mean, it really is extraordinary. I could get why he would be a bit you know, exhausted in many ways, and it culminating in you know, accomplishment and relief.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was, you know, I think we talked about it very early in the season, is that, you know, I'll be honest, I didn't think the league was going to be won this year. I really didn't. At the start of the season, just because of the logistics of it and the amount of change that we'd have to go through. But I get the sense almost that, you know, everything that we were told by the seasoned under watchers is it'll take a few transfer windows. It'll take at least a year. It'll take maybe, you know, with the second season, you'll start to see some cohesion there. And I suspect in the background, there was a little bit of at Celtic sort of saying, you haven't really got a year, mate. You've got to make this work because we have to win the league this year. I'm not saying his job would have been on the line, but I think he's an intelligent person. I think he instinctively knew, because of the Champions League situation, that really you can't really take a year here. You've got to get this over the line somehow. And that was probably stretching what he felt he was capable of doing based on his previous experiences. And that's, as I say, before you even take into account what actually needed to be done to create a coherent team. So all of that being said, I think that explains the huge outpouring of emotion that's come from him over the last few days, which was surprising, but lovely to see as well.
Yeah, and I think from a supporter's perspective, I see Plixi, and I won't try to finish that, in the comments stated, you know, something to the effect that, you know, we're not used to this kind of title challenge either, this kind of old school title race. And again, one of the first pieces I wrote last summer for the Celtic Way was talking about kind of a back to the future concept, which is we're finally probably entering, you know, an era of, let's call it relative parity, meaning that you're going to have kind of like, you know, when both clubs have had in the same, regardless of how they do it, spending similar or comparable amounts of money on players in wages. And, you know, last season was such an odd season. 1920 was truncated, and it was really the first season that Rangers had kind of returned within the zip code, the area code of, or the ballpark of our spending. So this is all kind of fresh and new to a lot of people. I mean, it's literally been a long time since we've had a title challenge go down to this degree, where you're kind of on pins and needles for months on end. And that's exhausting too, just as a supporter, where, you know, people would kind of trump up, you know, phony concern in January when Aberdeen was supposedly chasing us under dial or that kind of thing. But yeah, so we had to get our legs stretched out again after, you know, a good decade of not really experiencing it.
I can't get too excited about that line of logic, because to me, you know, when you mentioned truncated, so you mentioned trunk, so I'm going to hop to, there are so many elephants in that room, right? I mean, you know, that sort of, oh, great, the old firm's back type room. There's so many elephants there. I mean, to me, yes, I get the whole argument, not just from a sporting challenge perspective, but also from a economic perspective around having, you know, a league that's got some competition to it. I mean, obviously, it has to, otherwise, you know, people lose interest. I get that, but it can't be at any cost. It can't be. It simply can't be. You know, Celtic have earned the right to be the biggest club in Scotland. You know, they've spent, you know, best part of 28, 30 years building a football club from when, you know, Fergus McCann took over to be in the position that they're in now. Right. It wasn't an overnight thing. It wasn't a 2-year project. This has been a 30-year project to build a football club that in the context of Scottish football dwarfs it. Right. Not through nefarious reasons, not through not paying taxes, not through paying players or you know, getting borrowings from the bank that are not available to anybody else. It's through performance on the pitch and through your prudent management. So I have a bit of a trouble with the, oh, it's a lot better than you know, Aberdeen being 30 points behind. I get the sporting argument to that, but we earned that right, and we still earned that right. So, you know, competition's great, but, you know, what I want to see is a well-run Aberdeen, you know, a well-run Hearts, a well-run Hibs, which we've not seen this year at all, actually. Those clubs could be doing an awful lot better. That's justifiable competition. That's earned competition, you know, and that's what I'm all for. And if that's how the league becomes competitive, then that's great. And if the league isn't competitive because other clubs can't run themselves in a professional and legal way, then Celtic hammer everybody in Scotland, then that's just the way it's got to be.
Yeah, and I'm not going to disagree with any of your points. My point was, I was attempting to make a bit of a different point, which is more of just the basic.
I decided to focus on another aspect.
Yeah, well, no, it's fair enough. It's more so just the basic, like, psychological experience of this season as a supporter having been different, regardless of how or why. You know, I think that probably contributed. I mean, Ange would have his own situation, and, you know, all the people at the club on the staff and et cetera, with this grind, and the supporters having our own experience of going through something that's, you know, like I said, we're a little rusty on. So I think that the combination of all that really contributed probably to that big emotional.
Possibly, but I would also argue it was even more important, and this is just my opinion. I say what I'm about to say, it sounds like one of these horrible things where you're trying to speak for the support. I'm not. It's just my opinion, right? Is I think the level of connection that the club, and certainly the team, the manager, and the players have now got backed with the supporters has been a huge reason for, you know, the joy and the outpourings over the last week. Celtic is a club about connections. It is a community. It is a movement. That's not to say that it's a single mind and it's a hive mind and everyone's of the same opinion. We all know from social media that's not the case. But it's on certain fundamentals and what's important. I think there is a connection there, and I think that has been lost over a number of years for many reasons, which we're not going to go into on this particular podcast. But I think people are feeling, I hope anyway, and I certainly I do, feeling a greater sense of that connection, and therefore to not just to win, but to win whilst taking everybody with you is really what you want your football club to do, I think, as most supporters would. You know, I would honestly hate to be a Newcastle United supporter if they win the Premier League next year, or, you know, having struggled under you know, Ashley's kind of horrible sort of rule, and now they've got, you know, this horrendous regime that run them. I mean, how would you feel about that? What does that say to you about what you believe in, what your values are? It'd be a horrendous situation. So I think that connection is really, really important. And that to me, even more so than did it go down to the last day or were within X points or Y points? It was more that the joyousness of the football that's been played, the style of play, the ambition that's being shown in terms of wanting to go out and entertain and win at the same time. I think that piece has really helped bring it together.
I agree. All good points. But again, I think it all focuses back on one individual. Hmm. Really, I mean, the cult of personality.
I'll say two. You carry on, but I think there's two key things. But go on.
Yeah. I think the unique personality, and you know, you get the substance on the competency side, meaning that the basics of doing the job that the man's hired to do, and then you get everything else that comes with it, and the total package of that it is a force du jour. I mean, it really is. So I joked, I tweeted it. I mean, whatever they're paying him, you know, and I know he's talked in certain humble ways, and which is also part of the package of the man, it appears. But, you know, he should, if he had a ruthless agent, he should have the board of Celtic bent over a barrel to take a percentage of profits out of whatever Champions League money is brought in. Because if you just think both monetarily directly, but also like we'll call it the goodwill, to use an accounting name or a metric or concept, the goodwill that he's brought back to the club, it's almost priceless. So yeah, I just think it's really remarkable overall what he's been able to provide for the club.
Yeah, and I don't think he's actually even started yet, you know, coming in as he did on his own and almost making a statement that, you know, if we're going to, you know, start mid-June, if we start changing the backroom staff, that's just another level of change to manage and another set of people to kind of deal with. So, you know, I don't know whether he consciously went with what we had because he felt it was good enough, or whether he felt actually this is the best I can do, or what, but it was, you know, probably a level of change that he didn't maybe want to face on top of everything else. I still think he's got his own mark to make on the club in terms of
100% agree.
Recruitment and structure and, you know, direction and so forth. So for me, this is really just the beginning. And the reason that I mentioned, I think there were two key things that happened, two the most important things that happened for Celtic this year were both off the pitch. One was hiring Postecoglou, and the other was Peter Lowell leaving. Because you can see the way that the football club has behaved over recruitment in the summer, and especially in January, and potentially now, we're just behaving in a completely different way, and that all starts from the CEO and what he sees as his remit, and what he believes is the way that things should be done. And it looks like, you know, Ange is getting things done the way he wants them done, and he's being supported in that so far. You know, I know we've kind of been here before. You know, we felt that Rodgers got what he wanted until it got to the second summer, and then it all just went to shit. You know, we had the Boya, we had the Dembele fiasco, we had the Boyata fiasco.
McGinn, you know, can we go down through them?
So we had all that, right? And that may happen again, but I'm gonna, you know, cautiously say I don't think it will. I think we're in a new era, both in terms of the manager, but also in terms of the board's relationship with the manager and how the board feels they have to behave to support the manager. And I think those two things are the most important things that have happened over the last year. And you know, we've got, you know, so many decisions right in terms of what happens on the pitch because of that.
Yeah, and I you know, for me, it's mostly, I shouldn't say, I always hate to say all, but as close to all as you can get reasonably positive in the short to intermediate term in that regard. I mean, I think that the relative optimism of all these things that we've talked about, I mean, I have my little quixotic things that I could, you know, I've slung a few arrows at Ange over the season, particularly on injuries, that kind of thing. But, you know, the short intermediate term, really, really positive. But when you have a cult of personality who's, you know, almost like a benevolent king, and that's really what we're going towards here. And, you know, if you can find that benevolent king, there's nothing wrong that says that that's inherently worse than, let's say, democracy, right? As a political structure. If you can find that benevolent king who's not going to, you know, murder and pillage and plunder.
Well, you may not know this in terms of football history, but especially international level, it used to be a democracy. Football, the national teams of certainly Scotland and even England and Wales and so forth were picked by a committee. And in rugby, they did the same up until relatively recently. It was a panel of people. So actually, that model that you've said there is not so far fetched. That has existed in the past.
Yeah, and I guess what I was fair point. I wouldn't know the history on rugby for 100%. But yeah, even just through my history and watching what's going on with the U.S. men's national team, I know that that's how they had done it for quite some time, much to the dismay of some. But you know, so these are always power struggles, organizational dynamics and politics and all that stuff. But, you know, when you have someone who's that important, who's not in the role, now maybe, and again, we have no idea how this is going to work out over time. Hopefully he's here for as long as possible. But, you know, if he's not, you know, if he's not here for 10 years, then, you know, you get a power vacuum that occurs when you get, you know, he's not coming in as a director of football operations. He's not someone who's the architect in a role that if you're going to have a benevolent king, one that's going to, you know, rule for two decades, as opposed to a benevolent king who's only going to be around for a couple of years. And, you know, so those are all issues that we can worry about and talk about for the years to come.
Yeah, it's too early for me to talk about succession planning. I don't want to go.
Yeah, there. Exactly.
let's enjoy this.
Exactly. Although hopefully, you know, that's what the board should be worried about, because you always need to have contingencies. But well, let's get to some of the specifics on the because there's not a lot to talk about with the game. I mean, the game was basically, you know, it was a 6-0 game. Quite frankly, I wasn't all that wrapped up in thinking about things from an analytical perspective, given everything that was going on. And I haven't gone back to rewatch it. So, again, if you have any analytical insight to share, please feel free to do so. I think kind of what we can talk about next is, you know, the two men who have decided for, or however it's worked out, they're departing the club after long tenures of really excellent success and service to the club. So I think we should talk about Nero, which, by the way, I don't know what that, like, I struggle with his name enunciating it anyway, but I guess that's a nickname. I don't know if there's others.
I guess so. I guess it's a sort of a hat tip to, you know, probably Roman centurion type of or Roman you know, Caesar or whatever, you know what I mean?
It's like, yeah,
it's something grand like that, I think.
I like it. I just didn't know if there was a cultural aspect.
I don't believe so, unless I'm missing something. I'm sure somebody in the comments will come up with something a little bit more clever than that. I just took it as being like a sort of, you know, a reference,
like Barky.
Yeah, I mean, a Barky. I'm gonna turn you into something a dog does. Yeah, there's two things that dogs do frequently, and you're one of them.
Well, I'm gonna steal Nero, so I don't have to try to pronounce his last name. So Nero and Rogic, you know, just great send-offs, emotional send-offs. So maybe share some of your thoughts on their tenures and the roles that they've played through the years.
So, I mean, I think fascinating careers in many ways. I mean, it's unusual for two players to play so long at a big club without actually being in almost every game. I mean, when Bitton first joined, the club. He was actually a first pick for pretty much his first two seasons. And it was really, he played with Scott Brown as a double pivot during Ronnie Dyla's time, which is a terrible idea if you think about it. Although I think it was a little bit of, Bitton and Brown and Johansson, which again is a terrible idea. It's really slow.
Some squad building that was.
Not very creative. But in that time, he was a first pick. And then really when Rodgers came, there was this notion of kind of, and I don't know what came first. I don't know whether Bitton played centre back for Israel, maybe on occasion, his national team, and then that became a thing, or whether it was Rodgers' idea to, because Rodgers, had these creative ideas, these cleverer than thou sort of, which had some merit, right? So we saw Bitton appearing at centre back. Now, some of it was through necessity, and some of it was through, Rodgers thinking this was a great idea. And I think in some ways his Celtic career never recovered, because he was never a regular after that. And the next sort of 6 years really have been punctuated with a lot of appearances at centre half, the odd appearance in midfield. And what is the kind of counterpoint to when we come on to Rogic is, when you think about Nir Bitton, you remember some really, really bad performances. that your memory, your moments that you remember. I will never get Astana away, the 4-3 loss. I'll never get that out of my mind in terms of just an absolutely horrendous centre-back performance. And even this season, to his first game against Midtjylland, where he got sent off for arguing with the referee or some stupid altercation with one of their players having already been booked. I mean, it's incredible that he came back from that, because as a manager, you sort of think, I can't trust you. I cannot trust you in the heat of battle in a key game to actually help the team, get through this. But he became quite important to Postecoglou, and he played his role this season, as many players did, who didn't necessarily play every game, but he played an important role in the squad and in the side, but back to his preferred, I think should be his preferred position of central midfield. And so, you go through the trophies, whatever it is, 16 trophies or 18 trophies that he's won. Tremendous. He's made over 250 appearances for Celtic, which in most clubs would get you into the Hall of Fame for that particular club. So you cannot argue with that. You cannot argue that he's found a way to be useful for a number of different managers in a number of different roles. And he's almost become what I call backbone, as in he's one of the individuals who is a senior professional in the dressing room, has utility over and beyond what he does on the pitch, is seen as somebody who's important to have around the club. But, my understanding is with both players, the club wanted them both to stay, and there was contract extensions on the table, but for personal and family reasons, they feel it's time to move on. So, having said all that, trying to be balanced here, I think, we celebrate Bitton. He was a key holding midfielder for two titles. He contributed to many, many more. You couldn't point to a game where you could say, oh, that was near Bitton's game. He won that cup semi-final, or I think he had some great games, obviously. I mean, this season, I think he came on at Ibrox and actually was brilliant and really just helped to solidify the midfield. That was what he was capable of doing. There's many games where he did play at the back, and he was playing, home games against lesser opposition where he was, range of passing was just superb, and he was excellent. So, it's sad to see him go, but, at the end of the day, he's a squad player, and, hopefully it'll be somebody that we can replace. So I don't know if you want to say some words on Bitton before we get to Rogic.
I think that might be the way to do it. Yeah. So as you were speaking there, the one game that sticks out to me, and as I'm getting older, my memory's not what it used to be. So the one game that does jump out to me where he put in just a really solid performance. And again, I agree with you, because of he's got this kind of catalog of moments of madness and a couple of real doozy games mixed in there. I think it's harder to remember some of the really good games that he had. And the one that jumps out to me, just popped into my head, was I think it was the first derby in 1920, when we ambushed them with the long kick out to the side that Edouard hit out, and I think he played center back that game.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, and he was terrific that day.
Yeah, he was.
So there were those kind of games in there mixed in, and I think he's one of those guys where I think that if it hadn't have been for injuries, and maybe some internal politics is my guess, I would have loved to have seen him as the middle of the 4-3-3 that Rodgers deployed, meaning that if Biton would have been, Nero would have been able to, you know, kind of go into that role, because he had a lot of fitness issues kind of coming out of that second Dyla season, and was never really able to stay consistently fit, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, his record is now, you know, he'll play 6-7 games and he'll miss 2 or 3, and it's that kind of cycle.
Yeah, so it's probably something chronic going on there. But we had talked about this on some prior episodes. I've mentioned that, you know, I'd gone back through a historical study at one point, just looking at outlier games and kind of ranking all of the games that I had in Y-Scout. So literally every single game ranked by non-penalty XG differential, and just sort them. And then I'd go through and say, okay, what players were in this game? What game? You know, just because I'm a loser and I do spend my time doing such things. And it was really interesting that Nero was oversampled in kind of the top games. Hmm. Again, that might be correlation as opposed to causation. But as you and I have discussed, the one real outlier skill that he seems to have had is that kind of pack passing, that ability to break lines. That's one thing that I would have liked to have seen is maybe in that 16-17 season into 17-18, had he been able to stay fit and gotten selected, which again, probably not. He probably wasn't going to supplant Brown, but in my alternate universe, that would have been something I would have liked to have seen, given the attacking talent that he would have had in front of him to break lines and hit guys like Sinclair and Dembele and Edouard and, you know, Forrest at peak Forrest. I mean, that would have been, I think, something else to maybe see.
He's had to basically play in the same position as Brown, who was rarely injured, and McGregor, who's never injured. So right. That, you know, to still rack up that number of appearances whilst essentially being a backup to two, you know, genuine legends in that respect is quite remarkable, really.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll say, and then we'll move on to Rogic, is, and I've said this on prior episodes, I think that the flexibility of a quality player being able to play in different positions and to be at least functional in multiple positions is really just a valuable, if you're going to have a squad player, that I think that's a credit to him, and really how good of a player he is, and he's done that. He's done that for his country. He's played in different positions, different roles. So, I think that's a really positive way to remember him too, is how much he contributed and doing things like go to playing in what was it, 40 degree heat in Astana, and yes, come off in a horrible game, but you know, the fact that he was able to even be in a position where a manager like Rodgers would say, "Hey, I'm going to use him this way." You know, not everyone would be able to make that kind of transition. So I think there's some credit to be attributed there. So let's move on to Rogic, who's probably a little easier to discuss.
No, absolutely. And again, you know, is somebody who I think actually this season, remarkably, is going to be the season where he's contributed the most minutes he's ever contributed to Celtic. He's never got above, I think it's 2000, only once above 2,500 minutes, you know, and if you break it down into how many games equivalent has he played, he's never broken 30, which means that in every season he's been here, he's essentially played less than half the games, you know, and that's just, and so it's very difficult with Rogic, you know, because in that respect, because he never completely dominated a season or contributed in a season consistently over a long number of games. It's just never happened. Injury has always come into play. It's been double figures, numbers of games lost to injury virtually every season, on top of he's the one most likely to miss games through international call-ups because of the travel logistics of getting back to Australia and the Far East, etc. So what I think we've had with Rogic is a player who's contributed great, almost the reverse Bitton. He's contributed great moments. He is the probably of all the players in the squad, actually, he has been the provider of moments, of great moments for the support in games. And do you remember that 10 game stretch at the turn of the year when it's never been that with Rogic. It's been, do you remember those moments? Do you remember that goal that, you know, clinched the league at Kilmarnock? Do you remember, you know, obviously the goal of the season at Dundee United this season again? Do you remember? And of course, everybody remembers the treble clinching goal, which for me personally is possibly the happiest, most joyful goal I've ever seen for Celtic. You know, and I'm saying that because I'm somebody who's always kind of lived in England, so the vagaries of what games you actually get to see, there's probably huge swathes of the 80s and 90s, which are so very few Celtic games, for example. So 90s, probably not an issue. but in terms of, you know, what goal will live in your memory the longest, it will be that goal at Hampden. You know, me and the kids did a huddle in the front room. I was in tears. It went on quite a long time. It was just the most joyful outburst of emotion. I've never seen, you know, I must have watched O'Neill's Celtic team win a treble, but that was a long time ago, and I think I was younger and probably a little bit more, it's a treble. Now I really, really appreciate it, and he provided that moment, and that's the sort of thing he was capable of. So, you know, he, for that reason alone, he'll live in the memory for a long time. But he created so many moments. I mean, a player that has, you know, the build of a rugby back, but you know, the balletic ability of a tiny ballerina, you know, like a little swan in Swan Lake or something, you know, the ability to take the ball under pressure and you know, to manipulate it to get out of trouble, other players hanging off him like he's a big giant with the ball at his feet. It's just, you know, great images. I think we all have those memories of him there. So yeah, incredible career. You know, he has given his best years, and it's great to see someone like him. I think he's very much a Celtic player. He is the Australian Riquelme, I would call him. You know, very much a throwback to the classic number 10s of years gone by, who, you know, he really doesn't give you a lot when he's not on the ball, but when he is on the ball, you know, magic things can happen. So I think there'll always be a huge amount of fondness and affection for Rogic, and a little bit of regret, if I'm honest, that, as I say, yeah, I suppose if he had kept fit and he could put a run of 20, 30 games consecutively together in a season, then you would probably be looking at one of the best number 10s in the world. But that's why we've had him for so long, I suppose, is that there was never that consistency there. But as I say, some absolutely great moments.
Yeah, again, as you were going over that, It jumped into my mind that Nero is almost the Bizarro Rogic, meaning that you've got those handful of moments of madness that kind of probably sway the narrative on his career, perhaps a little bit unfairly, given some of the quality that he did have at times. And then Rogic is like the opposite of that, where you have these just tremendous moments that probably sway things in a positive direction when, you know, the week-to-week, month-to-month Rogic experience wasn't necessarily that of greatness.
Yeah. I mean, you average his appearances for Celtic. You average 57 minutes per appearance. Yeah, you know, that in itself is remarkable because he was really a sub.
Yeah, and I think, again, to kind of come back to the season and... again, something we probably talked more about back in the fall when they were getting flogged, him and Turnbull, was, you know, I was very skeptical coming into this season, having looked at Ange's style of play and then seeing it firsthand, that particularly Rogic would be able to meet the demands physically. And, I mean, it wasn't ideal, but man, did he make it work. And the amount that I mean, you could see it, not only him, I mean, just across the squad, guys like Ralston, you could just see their body shape change where, you know, he became a leaner, meaner midfielder and player to be able to try and play this way. And this goes back to that culture that Ange has set and that people at the club, the players, most importantly, seems like have bought into. You know, and there's personal sacrifice that goes along with that. The discipline of living that way and to be able to get your something I could stand up and show everyone I do not have in order to get your body fat down. And I mean, just be able to do that because he's not gifted with the natural abilities that would lend you to say, oh, okay, well, he's a perfect fit for Ange's attacking eight role. And the fact that him, and again, to Turnbull's credit as well, but Rogic in particular, I mean, just I think that stretch of 4 months, I just thought until the reinforcements arrived in January, I mean, it was really remarkable in my mind that he was able to make the sacrifices and the commitment and follow through and be able to do it. And, you know, he's one of the ones that did not end up getting a significant longer term injury.
Yeah.
Which and probably, I would have bet the opposite. You know, if you're going to say, oh, I don't think he's going to be able to do it. And, oh, he's going to do all this, this, and this, and go through it without picking up an injury. And all these other people are, I would have been like, you're freaking crazy.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I think a couple of people in the comments are commenting on, you know, Europe and is this really actually the way forward? And I did check earlier, you know, his expected scoring contribution, so expected goals and expected assists, was something like 0.5 per league game or per domestic game, which is fantastic for a midfielder. And it was 0.15 in European games. And that would be a problem, right? I don't think he can perform at the level that he does in the SPFL in European games. And especially as you're sacrificing a lot of defensive capability by having Rogic in the team. I mean, as I said before a few weeks ago, O'Reilly is broadly twice as productive defensively as Rogic is. You can't absorb that and have someone who's not actually contributing a hell of a lot in attack either. So I don't want to leave on a downer. You know, I think with Postecoglou, there's a little bit of old school. There's a lot of old school about him in terms of, you know, he wants to have a core of good, solid professionals that are good people in that dressing room. And I suspect that, you know, the likes of Rogic, Bitton, Forrest, you know, McGregor, probably McCarthy even would form, you know, that cabal of seasoned, experienced pros that keep everyone on their toes. And I think he would have been kept on for that reason, but we would have to have found a way to get more, you know, a more productive midfield in Europe. That problem would have been exacerbated. So that's the opportunity, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm fine with the departure from a strategic perspective. Again, above and beyond the welling up and the emotions, you know, the ruthless analytical side of me, these are the kind of changes we have to make. Yeah. Not, you know, those were peak Rogic years when he was putting up that performance in Europe. He's going to be 30 in December. So and this is probably because of all the things I just, you know, commended him on in the sacrifices and being able to do what he did in the duration of this season. That's probably going to be his physical peak. I mean, he cranked up the dial where he may have even been quicker, faster, and in better shape this season than he was 2 or 3 years ago. But that ain't happening going forward. Like you've set a new level and now he's going to start declining off of that. And, you know, he doesn't have a half a step to Champions League level. Right. This is not Conference League level that we're talking about or domestic level. This is going up with the big boys now. And, you know, I even worry about McGregor going into next season where, again, he's getting into that 29-30 range. Where is he going to have that pace, that explosiveness at an eight?
He's one actually that struggled. I say struggled. Kyle McGregor struggling, you know, most players would die for, right? But relative to his previous performances, McGregor actually struggled to influence both the Dundee United game and the Motherwell game. I think he was as emotionally, if not physically, as tired as Postecoglou was in dragging the team over the line. Yep. And he's got another potentially a month of international football ahead of him. So I think McGregor needs a rest more than any player.
Yeah, agreed. And maybe from a futuristic perspective, and we'll get to that in a little bit here, more specifically and expansively, is the most interesting comment of the week, I thought, was Ange referencing a midfielder as a priority. And obviously, that's an area that you and I have discussed in recent months as a dream box to check would be to bring in that stud. Now, again, I have my own thoughts on the profile of who and what that should be. I tend to lean towards very young, if possible, and we seem to be still focusing on kind of, as I'll call them, middle age footballers, kind of 24, 25, 26 area. If anything, I think Nero would have been a more natural fit to stay just because of that flexibility domestically, right? That utility, that Swiss Army knife, where, you know, you're playing Dundee. Not going to be Dundee now. Inverness,
Kilmarnock.
Inverness or Kilmarnock. On a Sunday or a Saturday following, you know, playing, knowing our luck, Barcelona.
That would be a good draw.
Well, that would be good. But just the repetitiveness of it is, you know, playing Nero at the six, or, you know, we'll see. Maybe. That's the other thing that we can talk about as we go forward. I expect we're going to see more flexibility out of Postecoglou going next season too. I mean, that we were pretty rigid in this 4-3-3 for pretty much the whole season. And he's, if you look at his track record in second season and other places, he's also gotten to be a little bit more dynamic, mm-hmm. not still playing the same way, obviously, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. you know, going more to 4-2-3-1 or even mixing in 3-4-2-1 or 3-4-1-2, those kind of setups. So, you know, Nero would have been one that you could move around a little more. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm completely content because he's even more advanced. And the idea that he was going to be able to compete at Europe as a midfielder, I think, is, you know, unrealistic at the Champions League level. So, so that segues to maybe we'll talk about one other and probably the most successful person at the club that has been in the headlines, which is the extension that James Forrest was given and signed. And I think maybe some of what you talked about earlier about dressing room dynamics and the fact that these two guys are leaving apparently may have factored into this. But what are your thoughts on Forrest and his kind of role, and what do you see going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised. And I'm still surprised, but if I try and rationalize it, and the reason I was surprised is because, you know, he's 30 now. You know, he's had he's had a great season. He's been injury hit.
It's been a rough two seasons.
Two seasons, yeah. Sorry, yeah, absolutely. So,
he'll be 31 in July.
Yeah. So, you know, is a 31-year-old winger who you know really relies on explosive pace over short distances to earn space and to get the ball across or to get shots in, you know, is he going to improve? I just don't see that he will. You know, that's not to say you can't at the same time and in the same breath acknowledge what a wonderful Celtic career he's had and what a marvellous player he has been for Celtic. I just don't know what it says about what his role is going to be going forward. Now, if the idea is that, you know, Postecoglou doesn't want to lose all his senior pros, that Forrest has a lot of utility in being a good squad player to have around, that he's going to be a filler in, that he's going to maybe do different jobs, maybe on the left, on the right, even sometimes through the middle. And you know, because I suspect he was one of the top earners, you know, he's now not one of the top earners, and that's reflected in the length of contract. If all of those things are true, I suppose I could be quite sanguine about it. But if the case is he remains one of the top earners, he's now got another 3 years and he's going to play a pivotal role in the team going forward, I'm scratching my head from an analytical perspective.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. I guess I'm a big softy with some of this stuff, despite probably.
Oh, yeah, we all are.
My brand. Yeah. So, you know, you get a couple of people on Twitter, but I think it was Kevin, a guy who interacts with me quite a bit, had brought up a good point about the homegrown qualification for Europe. Now, that wouldn't necessarily mean give the guy a 3-year deal to make sure that we have enough for Europe heading into this year. But if you think about squad planning, I mean, who could be leaving? And we already have likely exodus of maybe Mikey Johnston. We don't know what Stephen Welsh, the plans are there. You know, so there's a fair amount of potential turnover in homegrown, and you don't have a pipeline of academy talent that's poised and ready to make that leap. Mm. So that was a good point that I hadn't thought of that was mm-hmm. raised as it came in. Again, I'm not sure about the 3-year aspect. But you know, the fact that he came up through the academy, we just have no idea what the contract details are, obviously. You know, we don't know historical negotiations where maybe he stuck at the club at a time when, you know, he could have gotten more money down south, and, you know, maybe he didn't hold the club's feet to the fire to squeeze out every last nickel in contract negotiations. So you just never know with these kind of potential loyalty aspects of it. I agree with you. I mean, I would think he's probably going to be a depth option again to play maybe some of these post-European games. And I think against bottom six teams, I don't have any concerns where we're going to have teams pinned back that he can't function at a sufficient level. Because again, most of the stuff that he's really good at, I think translates to that, you know, our pressing and counter-pressing isn't as big of a deal when we've got, you know, some of these teams, pinned back. So, and he's still just a really talented guy, high skill level. I don't have an issue with it at all, given all of the backdrop. But again, it comes down to another slot that probably isn't ruthlessly efficiently being allocated, and that creates, you know, dynamics that you need to be even better in the other decisions that you make to kind of have this luxury. I think it's worth it given who he is and his role at the club and his tenure at the club, but I think reasonable people can disagree on that kind of thing. Well, we're at 51 minutes. So let's talk about the future then. Maybe do 5 or 10 minutes on that, and then we'll get everyone the heck out of here. I'll peruse some of the comments here to see if there's any other ones that we can bring up. I appreciate everyone commenting, and we got 140 people viewing live. You all need to get lives. So going forward, what are your thoughts on, you know, kind of planning for next season? You know, I think we're generally optimistic, but, you know, what kind of, where's your head at as far as where we're heading?
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of, you know, doubt around the squad. There's a potential for a lot of changes still. You know, I think there's a probably a rump of reasonably expensive senior professionals. So I'm thinking, you know, Barkas, Bolongoli, probably Julian, Soro.
It's crazy how many people should be out.
Yeti, you know, we really need to be freeing up. These are players that clearly are not going to be playing a part. They're all kind of mid-20s guys on probably quite good wages. There's probably a few youngsters. I say youngsters, I mean, there's players who are out on loan who are probably too old for the B team that play in the Lowland League again next season. I think there's quite a strict kind of age limit there. So if you're 21, if you're not sort of age 20 in the year of that season, then I think you're too old. So if you're 21, 22 now. So I'm thinking about players like Afolabi, Coffey, you know, even Hazard that's out on loan, McEnroy, Shaw, Connell, Luca Connell, etc., Robertson. You know, these sort of players, like you say, they don't look like they're going to be first team ready, or there's no real indication that is the case. So if you add all that together, and then you consider players that you do wonder what the future might hold. So again, I think you mentioned them already. You know, you mentioned Welsh, you mentioned probably Scales, McCarthy. I know I'm allowed to say Scales because Ender's not here. And Ender's busy causing, you know, mayhem in Spain and probably going to get arrested. If you think of players like that, then, you know, I'm sure we won't lose all of those players, but that's a tremendous potential for, again, tremendous amount of turnover. We're looking at, you know, 15, 20 players. And then you're looking at, you know, as I say, will he look to recalibrate some of the back room as well? Will he look to put more of his, does he feel he's gone now got the authority to perhaps get more of a back room in the widest sense? I don't just mean like his coaches. I mean, the whole structure, infrastructure there that he wants. That all suggests a heck of a lot more change. You know, for me, priorities are the same as I think when the last time we discussed this, it hadn't really changed. I think if I went through, I could make a case for, you know, a goalkeeper that's probably more agile and better with their feet, even if it's just a backup for a year or to bring in and to start sort of, you know, sharing the load with Hart. I'm not going to get into the whole Carter Vickers Jota thing because we simply don't know what's going to happen. And it's just painful to consider, again, lone players that you fall in love with and what's going to happen to them. So we could be looking at least two centre-backs. We'd definitely need some more cover at left-back. We're probably looking for another, at least one more number eight, possibly two, at least one more wide person. The only position that actually looks quite well covered, considering where we normally go to in the start of a new season, is striker, where you've you know, arguably got four players that can play that very, very well. But other than that, there's probably, I would say, five starters that arguably you could say that you could make a pitch for.
So if I'll push on you here a little bit, because I'm curious what your answer will be. If the club decided that they wanted to, because I don't think that from a financial perspective, I don't think there's going to be a requirement to do this. So that's a nice position to be in from a flexibility perspective. But if there were one player that you would say, okay, the club's kind of reimpose this discipline of monetizing a player's value to bring in resources to reinvest, what player would you think fits that profile and that you would not have a problem with, on top of that, where you would be fine, if not fine, but you know what I mean, that we could maybe acquire someone who could replace their production?
I mean, I don't think there's anyone. I was just looking through there. I don't think there's anyone in the squad currently who resembles the profile of an Ayer or an Edouard or somebody like that, who has put together three or four seasons of consistently strong performances from a young age and is in that sort of early 20s bracket where you're going to get a premium fee and is probably, from a career perspective, looking for that big move. The only one that even comes close to that would be Turnbull. He's the only one. But even he had a very injury hit campaign. And although I think he has posted a couple of good seasons when he has played with Celtic, and he's 22, you know, and he's got 2 years left on his contract, Turnbull. He's the only one that I think you would even remotely resemble that. I don't think the Japanese guys, or O'Reilly or Giacomacco, somebody that's signed in the last sort of 9 months, would be looking to move on, or any hint of that, or would the club be looking to cash in on? So I don't know what we would have done if we hadn't got into the Champions League. And let's say we had to sell somebody. I don't know who we would have gone to, actually. That's probably a bit of a concern.
Yeah, I think we probably would have needed to. Or may have ended up in kind of taking either or both of the loan players out of the picture from a resource perspective. But the only other one that I would even think about is Abada. And that's more so from a... you know, he still, his profile is one where he's probably going to be attractive in the transfer market, meaning that as the market's going down, market's getting more efficient and moving down the age brackets, where you're seeing kind of 18, 19, 20 year olds. You know, I think he'll be 21 when for next season. You know, so given his production this season, I would think there might be a market for him where you could probably monetize a good chunk of what, and again, who knows what sell-on fees, knowing we don't know anything, but I think he came in for like 4 or 4.5. So if you could sell him for 10 or 12 or something like that, that wouldn't shock me. And to be honest, if we could get, and it's all what ifs and maybes, right? So if you could get 10 or 12 for him, I'd flip him in a heartbeat and reinvest it. Because again, I think as good as seasons as he had, I'm not sure from a fit perspective that we would have a hard time reinvesting that money and, you know, getting similar production. It's not probably going to be the exact same production, but something close enough where you could say, okay, because I don't, you know, depending on what goes on, he may not even be a lockdown starter heading into next season, depending on who stays. And, you know, they've said they're prioritizing a right wing potentially in a transfer market. Or at least I've heard that over and over again. So that would be, and I'm not saying we should do it. I'm just saying that would be the other one that if there was, because I think he would have a higher market relative to his situation. To your point, I agree with you on Turnbull. You'd probably be selling low on him. Whereas I think for Abada, if you're going to sell somebody, he had a good, really good season. He fits that age demographic where there's value, where there should be a market for him. And he's probably not, you know, if I was going to sketch out an ideal player for Ange's system, it's probably not him. Again, not that he hasn't done an amazing job this season, but so that would be the only other one I would think.
So as a sort of academic money ball type conversation, I completely get that. But I still think a lot of Celtic supporters, a lot of people completely underestimate how good he is. If you were to see his output put against 20-year-olds in the leagues across Europe, you'd be astonished. He'd be like, I think, in the top five, would be my guess, in terms of what he's done. And that has to, for smart clubs, like you say, they'll have him on his radar. But it'd be very unusual for him to leave after one season, I would have thought. But another season with a slightly, you know, improved performance, and yeah, I think we could be talking a big move.
Yeah, and again, I'm not advocating for it. I'm simply saying if they were going to try to pick someone else out, if they were going to do it, I think he would, because the cupboard is fairly bare for this profile, as you pointed out. So he would be the only other one that I could think of. Okay, well, we're up over the hour here, so I think we should probably just call it a day. I'm going to do a quick promotion here. Enda did not ask me to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. So as he's out gallivanting and frolicking across Europe, he's doing this football wanderer thing.
But he's not misbehaving. He's picking up his litter. Yeah, he's picking up his own litter.
He's being a good citizen of the world. So he's doing the football wanderer. You can catch that on Instagram. He also has a dedicated YouTube channel, so you can search for the football wanderer on both platforms and follow him on Twitter at Enda Cole. And follow his journey as he continues to neglect his real job, which is hosting this podcast. And now I've got to pick up the slack. I'm going to bill him personally. So he better have Venmo or something where he can pay me. But thank you everybody for tuning in. We'll keep everyone updated probably over Twitter as far as what the plans are. We don't have plans right now, so you'll find out when we find out. Alan, it's been a pleasure as always.
And thanks to everyone for all your comments and participation.
Yep, and we will talk to you later. Have a good one.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.